Information discussed in this podcast may be sensitive in nature to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Molly Dottillo was feeling a little bit bittersweet about going into her last year of college. See, Molly was a social butterfly. She loved the camaraderie and the community that campus life gave her. She also thrived academically being a straight-A student. But she might have been most well-known for her athleticism. Being a top 10 runner in the state of Indiana for her entire high school career and having obtained a scholarship for running and competing to Eastern Kentucky University. In the summer of 2004, Molly was taking summer classes through a college program at the Indianapolis University of Purdue, and she was living with her older brother, Nick, at Westlake Apartments. Molly had three summer classes scheduled, revolving around her love of music and singing, the other passion in her life besides running. In fact, Molly had been planning on attending an American Idol audition later that summer and was excitedly preparing and planning for that trip. On the morning of Tuesday, July 6th, Molly woke up and went to her morning class. Afterwards, she decided to go out and do some shopping. She had to pick up a couple of items for school, and she also wanted to buy her nephew a birthday present. Later that same day, Molly attended a party in her apartment building, leaving with a guy she had just met earlier that evening. Around 11 o'clock p.m., Molly made a phone call to a friend from a gas station payphone. Just as the friend answered, they heard a click. Molly had hung up. That would be the last known communication anyone had with Molly Dottillo, if that even counts as communication. And on July 8th, 2 days later, Molly would be officially reported as missing. Where is Molly Laura Dottillo? Molly Laura Dottillo was born on June 13, 1982, to parents Fred and Cherie. Molly was their ninth child, giving her an immediate four brothers and four sisters. Molly would remain the youngest in the family. Molly's family was very, very close. They were active members of the Church of Latter-day Saints, and it was pretty obvious to everyone who knew Molly, even as a very young child, that she was special. Now, it's too cliche to say that she lit up every room that she entered, so let's be a little bit more specific here. Molly was described as very bubbly and very energetic, the kind who approached everyone as being a possible friend for her. As she grew older, it also became very clear that Molly was very talented, and those around her took note of how she also encouraged everyone else. She excelled at sports and music, and while she was very driven to be the best that she could be, she was also very quick to encourage others to also be their best. Molly was driven to always improve, and that was in all facets of her life. Academically, she was a straight-A student. She excelled at track, at cross country, and the swim team, and she was an extremely talented singer and musician. Molly's high school career was admirable. Between her sports, she was a 7-time All-State Award winner, a 9-time state qualifier, 2 times a semi-state champion, and 9 times a sectional champion. Molly was definitely a winner, doing all of this while pulling off stellar grades, so it was no surprise to anyone that Molly would accept a scholarship to Eastern Kentucky University. Molly's college years were also full of running and athletics, but she continued to excel in the classroom with an intense focus on music. It was actually her dream to move to Nashville one day and become a country music performer. And if anyone seemed destined to achieve their dreams, it was Molly. The Disappearance. In the summer of 2004, Molly decided to take some college courses at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, also known as IUPUI. This program would allow her to earn credits for graduation at Eastern Kentucky. She would live with her older brother, Nick, at Westlake Apartments, and she would continue her studies. She was also planning on attending an American Idol audition later that summer and was eagerly preparing and practicing for that. Molly turned 22 years old that summer and was really enjoying the social atmosphere of her college years, especially knowing that they were soon coming to an end after she would graduate. On Tuesday, July 6th, 2004, Molly awoke as usual and went to class. Afterwards, she decided to go out and do some shopping. She needed to pick up some items for school, and she wanted to find a birthday present for her young nephew, who had a birthday later that month. Now, there is a window of time later in the afternoon in which we don't know what Molly was doing, but we do know where she was around 7 o'clock p.m. Molly was walking back from dropping off a job application at a nearby Wendy's restaurant. Molly's car needed some work done, and she needed to get the money to have it fixed before her trip to the American Idol auditions. After dropping off her application, she was walking back to her apartment at Westlake Apartments when she ran into a friend of her brother's. They stopped and they chatted for a very brief minute, and then they both went on their separate ways. Now, it's worth noting here also, as this will be important later, but this friend does remember seeing Molly holding her cell phone at this time. He said there was also nothing unusual about their encounter at all, and Molly seemed perfectly normal. From there, Molly went to a friend's apartment at that same apartment complex where she lived for kind of an impromptu get-together, a party. Now, despite it being a Tuesday, it was summertime, and I'm pretty sure there are no party restrictions for college students. They will gladly party as much on a Tuesday as they will on a Saturday. At her friend's apartment that night, she would meet a man named John Shelton. He asked her if she wanted to go out on the rowboat, and she said yes. Their apartment complex had a retention pond with a rowboat, and they decided to go out for kind of a moonlight row. They were seen together on the boat, just hanging out and seemingly having a good time. Afterwards, they brought the boat in and they decided to go to Taco Bell. Now, there's a point of discrepancy here I want to mention, and it is likely irrelevant in the grand scheme of things, but in the original reports, it stated that they walked to this Taco Bell. Then they would walk 3 miles in the opposite direction to go to a gas station. Now, I'm not sure at what point a car would become involved or even if it would, or if they just continued to walk these distances. What we do know for sure is that around 11 o'clock p.m., after they went to Taco Bell, they walked to a Thurston gas station on Crawfordsville Road. Now, this is in the opposite direction from her apartment. So they walked a couple miles to this Taco Bell, then they walked an additional couple miles to go to this gas station. While they were at this gas station, Molly used the payphone to call a friend that she was supposed to be meeting up with that evening. But when the friend answered the phone, all they heard was a click. The caller had hung up. Molly never made it to her friend's that night. And when Nick, Molly's brother and roommate, woke up the next morning, he quickly noticed that Molly wasn't there. And it didn't even seem that she had come home the night before, as nothing had been touched or moved or disturbed in any way. Now, this wasn't that unusual. He just figured she must have stayed with a friend and he went about his business for that day. Now, some will question this. Some will question his actions and why he thought that was normal. But to me, it doesn't necessarily seem abnormal. Molly was 22 years old. Nick was her brother. They certainly don't have to tell each other their every move. They were in college. And it seems perfectly logical to me that he just figured she'd be home later. But later that night, when Molly still wasn't home, he really began worrying. He noticed that she had left all of her personal items behind at the house. This would include her purse, her wallet, and her cell phone. There was no way to try and track her down using her phone if she had left it behind, and all of her friends were telling him that they hadn't seen her. By the next morning, after speaking to his family, Nick decided to call the local Indianapolis Police Department to report his sister as missing. Molly Laura DeTillo had disappeared. The Search and Investigation. There are a few categories of missing person reports which generally receive the least amount of attention. Anyone with any drug, alcohol, or criminal history. Teenagers. And college students. In Molly's case, the authorities just believed that she was being a typical college student and was avoiding her family, or maybe she was just out with another group of friends. They truly believed that she would just show back home soon. They took the report, but there was absolutely no action on their part. Meanwhile, Molly's family was quite worried. Molly was not a wild child. She didn't stay out of touch. She was super smart, and if she was going to go away for a while, she would take her money, she would take her cell phone, she would have let somebody know. And Molly certainly wouldn't go away or stay away for a while, not when she had college classes to attend to. We're talking about a very driven, straight-A student. None of this made any sense to her family or her friends. About a week after Molly vanished, with still no signs of her anywhere and with no one hearing from her at all, some of her family traveled to Indianapolis. They were shocked to learn that the police had never investigated anything. They had never even come to the apartment. Her family marched down to the authorities and demanded action. And finally, when law enforcement heard more about Molly and the fact that all of her belongings were left behind, I mean, everything was left behind, they finally began their investigation. Of course, by now, Molly had already been missing for a full week. They were able to nail down the timeline of events leading up to the party that night at the friend's apartment. They spoke to people who saw Molly and John in that rowboat and said everything seemed normal. And yet others saw them walking to Taco Bell together. And then there's that mysterious phone call. Now, I have some unanswered questions about this phone call. I think many people do. There's some details lacking in the reports, and authorities have stated that they will not be releasing all of the reporting that they have on this case, so we have to go with just what they have told us or released publicly. Somehow, it was confirmed that it was indeed Molly who made that phone call from the payphone. I had wondered if there was any surveillance or witnesses to confirm this, because the friend said that when they answered, all they heard was a click, and it was coming from a payphone. How could they be so certain that it was Molly? Now, while the details haven't been released as to how exactly detectives have confirmed it, they have said without hesitation, they know 100% that it was Molly. So this led them to the most important person they wanted to talk to, John Shelton. John was the young man she met at the party and was hanging out with that night, the man who she went out on the boat with, the man she walked to Taco Bell with, and now the man that she was seen at Thurston gas station with at 11 p.m. that night. So they do bring John in for questioning, and he admits that he was with Molly. And he even admits to being with her at the gas station. From there, however, he tells authorities that Molly went home afterwards, and that was the last he had seen her. John's behavior was described as being a little bit odd, and he immediately became a person of interest. He apparently had previous run-ins with law enforcement, and there were some details of his story that weren't making much sense to detectives. And when they did search John's car, they discovered vomit inside that hadn't been fully cleaned up. This is really where law enforcement goes quiet. It would become their belief, along with the families, that John Shelton had something to do with Molly's disappearance, and they believed that Molly was most likely no longer alive. Now, I know, I'm sure you're wondering what other evidence they might have to bring them to this conclusion. From the outside, despite him being maybe a creepy guy, I don't see a lot of physical evidence here. Maybe Molly did go home afterwards. But while authorities aren't telling us what they do know, they are telling the public that they are fairly certain of John's involvement, and they are in search of any physical evidence they need to try and bring charges against him for this crime. Now, meanwhile, John Shelton would be arrested and jailed on other unrelated charges. Upon the last records that I could find, he is not scheduled to be released from prison until 2038. Now, sadly, about a year and a half after Molly disappeared, her father passed away in December of 2005 without ever knowing what happened to his daughter, or even where she is. Molly's Law. Almost immediately, Molly's family was outraged at the slow response time from authorities. It was over a week before they began any type of investigation in Molly's disappearance. And that is crucial time, very, very crucial time in a missing person case. Not only does that increase the chances of actually finding the missing person, but also finding any physical or forensic evidence. The problem was, is that there was no protocol in place for dealing with missing person reports. It would be solely up to the investigators. There's no guidelines. In Molly's case, they simply said that since there was no evidence of a crime, there was just nothing they could do. Molly's family and friends began working with legislators to change this. It might be too late for Molly's case, but perhaps it could help other families. The Molly DiTillo Law, known as House Bill 1306, officially went into effect in Indiana on July 1st, 2007. The law was created to change how law enforcement agencies handle missing person cases, specifically those involving adults. It would require that authorities take immediate action. There's no waiting period. They have to take a missing report right away and they have to act. Police must also begin searching immediately for adults determined to be at high risk or at risk. It would also require at-risk missing persons to be entered into the National Crime Information Center, NCIC, database within 2 hours of their disappearance being reported. It also set up some standardized protocol. It would establish a uniform investigation system for all law enforcement agencies across the state of Indiana. This law would be strengthened even more in 2013, and it would be updated to include mandatory annual missing person training for police departments. The Indiana legislation here has served as a model for similar Molly's laws that would be enacted in other states to also protect missing adults. Molly's Law really paved the way for other states to adapt similar legislation. The civil suit. On October 9th, 2007, months after Molly's law passed in the state of Indiana, and more than 3 years after Molly vanished, her family filed a civil lawsuit against John Shelton and his father, Edwin Shelton. They claimed that John Shelton was responsible for Molly's death, and his father, Edwin, helped cover up that crime. This would be based on the family's own investigations with a private investigator. The lawsuit was filed asking for a total of $3.4 million in damages. Now, the family has said they never expect a dime of this money, and that wasn't the purpose behind the lawsuit. It was filed to help gain awareness of Molly's disappearance, and they were hopeful that with the lawsuit, they could also obtain additional information from law enforcement. Information that they had been withholding and not releasing, and they tried. Authorities fought back, stating that releasing the evidence they had would greatly jeopardize their case, and if they had to actually release it, they would be forced to stop investigating this case altogether. Which is quite odd. That almost sounds like a threat. In any event, they were not required to actually release that information, to the great dismay of the family, of course. But in November of 2010, the DiTillo family won that lawsuit by default. Neither John, who was incarcerated at the time, nor his father showed up to defend themselves in court. By default, the DiTillos were awarded $3.4 million, $1.7 million from John and $1.7 million from Edwin. Now, money they know they will never see, but it was the principle of the matter for them and the added awareness that it brought to Molly's case. Also, the hope that they would receive additional police or law enforcement files, which they unfortunately did not. And while John was in prison, where he still is today, his father's whereabouts have remained unknown. Both Sheltons received this default judgment against them, and while no one would ever hear from Edwin, at some point, John decided to fight this judgment. He submitted an appeal to the court, acting as his own lawyer, and the judge ultimately threw out his filing, calling it incoherent. The judgment stands. Indianapolis, Indiana. Let's take a look at Molly's movements up until her last known whereabouts, which would be the gas station where she made the phone call. Then we'll take a look at the western Indianapolis suburb where Edwin Shelton, John's father, lived. First, we'll start at the Westlake Apartments. This is the apartment complex Molly was living at with her brother Nick, and the apartment complex where she would meet John Shelton on the night of July 6th. These apartments are located on the western side of the city, and since we know that she did leave the apartments that night with John, I don't want to focus too much on them, but I do want to talk about the ponds. When I first heard that the apartments had a retention pond, I pictured a very small man-made pond. But taking a look at some photos and walking the area through Google Maps, it's actually a lot bigger than I imagined. There's floating docks you can walk over the water on, and there's several other docks throughout the perimeter of the water, and it's absolutely a beautiful pond that one would certainly enjoy boating on. But we do know that Molly left the apartment complex later that night. We don't know if she ever returned. No one saw her. Now, the pond was searched. To what extent, I don't know, but it is a significant body of water that John would have known about. Could he have brought Molly back there without being seen? It was the middle of the night. How thorough was that pond searched? Now, I think that it would be unlikely if John did do something to Molly that he would have returned to Westlake Apartments. Unlikely, but maybe not impossible. After leaving the apartments that night, John and Molly walked to the Taco Bell on 10th Street. Now, depending which way they went, this is about 2 miles from the apartment. And I also want to mention that most reports will state that they walked there. But I have to wonder at what point John got into his car, if he did at all. Now, after the Taco Bell, they were seen at Thurston Gas Station on Crawfordsville Road. This is about 3 miles away from the Taco Bell, and it's going in the opposite direction of the Westlake Apartments. At this point, we have to wonder what that phone call was about. Was Molly calling her friend to tell them that she was not going to meet with them after all that night, that she was with John, or was she maybe calling in some type of desperation or distress? Since the call hung up before Molly could talk or say anything, we will never know. John lived in an apartment complex just a couple of miles away from both the Taco Bell and this gas station. He lived at the Chapel Knoll Apartments on West 10th Street. There were no sightings reported of John and or Molly that night at the Chapel Knoll, and there were no reports of any odd or suspicious behaviors that I could find, but I still wanted to take a look at that area. It is definitely residential and light business. In addition to the apartments that are there, there's a couple of churches, there's a couple of other small businesses, and there's a truck yard. Now, the only other information I found that anyone has reported about Edwin Shelton, John's father, was that it was an anonymous tipster that stated that John had called his dad for help that night about disposing of a body. So if Edwin Shelton was involved, where was Edwin living at that time? I was not able to find an exact address, but reports do have him down as living in Avon, Indiana. Avon is known as a safe, family-friendly and more affluent suburb of Indianapolis, and it's about 15 miles to the west. Now, the further west and south you go outside of Avon, the landscape does quickly become a lot more rural and agricultural. That area is known for corn and soybean fields, scattered wooded properties, a lot of drainage ditches and creek beds. There are some rural county roads. There's also several isolated farmhouses and abandoned barns. Of course, I always want to take a look at any water sources in that area, and specifically to Avon, there is the White Lick Creek. This would be the primary natural waterway running through Avon. Now, while this creek isn't large, it does offer up some very thick tree-lined areas in some sections. There's also some floodplain areas, several little bridges and culverts, muddy banks and a lot of wooded access points. It's basically a very difficult area to search thoroughly during high vegetation seasons. And this creek does run very close to parks and subdivisions, although there are several rural stretches as well. There's also the Eagle Creek Reservoir. This is located east to southeast of Avon near Indianapolis. This is one of central Indiana's largest reservoirs. There is a lot of deep water in some places. There's heavy wooded shoreline sections. There is boat access, and there's a lot of connected parkland and trails. The White River is located further east, but it is a major river system in the area connected to many creeks throughout central Indiana. Now, because Avon, Indiana is also described as having several stormwater retention ponds, several small fishing ponds, several areas which are known as floodplains, several areas which are described as being in a floodplain, and there is some former gravel quarry lakes in the surrounding area. Now, it is important to mention that there has been no publicly discussed search for Molly in the Avon area, and everyone that I did speak to is not aware of any searches that happened in Avon for Molly. It seems most of the searches remained in the areas where she was last seen, the areas where that gas station was on Crawfordsville Road, the Taco Bell, and the Westlake Apartments. That's all very built-up, busy, residential business areas. There aren't a whole lot of areas where somebody could be hidden or concealed. And if Edwin Shelton was involved in some kind of cover-up, it's very possible, very likely even, that Molly was taken to a whole different part of the city, or maybe even a whole different part of the state. Now, Molly's case did receive some attention, mostly due to the work of her family and friends to get her name out there, to get her story out there. But I don't know that her case received as much attention as some other college students who vanished. Interestingly, Maura Murray, one of the most infamous missing person cases in the U.S., Maura vanished just a few months before Molly did in Haverhill, New Hampshire. Maura was a 21-year-old nursing student at the University of Massachusetts. She vanished on February 9, 2004, after crashing her car on a rural road in Haverhill. Witnesses saw her near the crash scene, but when police arrived minutes later, she was gone. All her belongings were found in the abandoned car, and extensive searches of the area turned up no sign of Maura. 2 years later, Brian Schaefer was a 27-year-old medical student at Ohio State University who disappeared in the early morning hours of April 1, 2006. This was after a night out in Columbus, Ohio. Surveillance video did capture him entering the Ugly Tuna Saluna, a bar near campus. There was never any footage found showing him leaving the bar. His disappearance became one of Ohio's most famous unsolved mysteries because investigators could not determine how he vanished from such a crowded bar, from such a crowded area of the city. There have been no confirmed sightings or physical evidence ever found of Brian. Lauren Spearer was a 20-year-old student at Indiana University, Bloomington. She disappeared in the early morning hours of June 3, 2011, after a night out with friends near campus. Surveillance footage and witness statements tracked her movements through downtown Bloomington, where she did appear heavily intoxicated. She was last known to be walking near her apartment area, but she never made it home. Investigators have long suspected foul play or maybe even an accidental overdose followed by a cover-up, although no one has ever been charged and Lauren has never been found. And there are so many others, so many. So what do you think happened to Molly Dottillo? Molly was 22 years old when she disappeared from Indianapolis, Indiana on July 6, 2004. She is described as being between 5 foot and 5 foot 1 inches tall and weighing around 100 pounds at that time. She had brown shoulder length hair and hazel green eyes. Molly wears glasses or contact lenses, and she does have several distinguishing features, including a brown birthmark on the outside of her right elbow and a slightly deformed left thumbnail described as hooked. She was last seen wearing a pink tie-dye shirt with a white collar. Molly was an Eastern Kentucky University student taking summer classes in Indianapolis at the time of her disappearance. Anyone with any information at all about Molly DiTillo's disappearance, her death, or the possible location of her remains is asked to contact the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department at 317-327-6160 or Crime Stoppers of Central Indiana at 317-262-TIPS. You can always, always remain anonymous through Crime Stoppers. Thank you so much for listening to Molly's story today. Despite knowing that something bad happened and knowing who most likely was responsible, Molly is still missing and her family still yearns for answers to bring Molly home where she belongs. Keep sharing her story. Someone out there just might hold the missing piece of the puzzle that could bring Molly home once and for all. If you have made it this far and would like to help our podcast reach more people, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. And a huge, huge thank you to those who have done so already. It truly does help these stories get the exposure they deserve. If you are interested in all of our episodes completely ad-free, you can join us over on Patreon. You will also find occasional bonus episodes as well. Our latest bonus episode talks about the disappearance of Ranelle Bennett, a young mother who vanished from the Navajo Nation in New Mexico. The link to our Patreon page can be found in the show notes. If we do have any case updates or news on any missing person cases, whether that's cases we've covered or other stories, we will share that over on our socials first. You can find the Where Are They podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and X. And you can also find our episodes in video format over on YouTube. This is a great way we can share photos of the missing person and any other relevant pictures, such as evidence photos, maps, etc. The link will be in our show notes, or you can always just search for the Where Are They podcast. If you do have any case suggestions for me, please reach out anytime via the socials or email me at canwefindthem@gmail.com. There is also a contact form on our website, wherearethepodcast.com. I'm specifically looking for the cases that are not receiving enough media attention or not enough attention, or maybe the cases that were receiving a lot of attention at one time and no longer are. Thank you again for listening to Molly's story today and helping us keep her story out there, keeping her name out there. Please share, and let's get more eyes on her case. We will be back again very soon with another unsolved missing persons story. And until then, stay safe and hug your loved ones.